friends. Welcome to the Mad Bro Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Davis. My co-host is Matthew Flowers. I want to encourage all y'all to check out our website at madbroradio.com. There's a donation link there if you'd like to help us out at all. And follow us on Twitter, on the Facebooks, all that good stuff. We're Mad Bro Radio everywhere. So, Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we're going to have a great guest on today, Mr. Christopher Bates, to talk about a wide variety of topics. But I wanted to, before we get into that segment of the show, I wanted to discuss something with you. Would you like to bring back the titled episode? It's something that we used to do, and we moved away from it when we started having more guests. But the having episode titles.
Oh, we not had titles?
Yeah, see, I figured like you don't actually listen to our shows, so you hadn't noticed. I've just been naming the shows like after the guest, so it's with Cynthia Maliski.
Titles.
All right, yeah, but let's bring back titles, okay? Because I know what this episode's going to be titled.
Okay? How can you know that already?
I already know. It's a foregone conclusion. This episode is going to be titled "Pink Floyd is Fucking Terrible."
Okay. I don't know if okay, we could go with that, I suppose.
Okay, so I drove down to Houston over the weekend. All right. And I didn't tell you I was going to do this ahead of time because I didn't want, like, to be unfairly influenced. I realize it's been, like, 10 years since I had given Pink Floyd a real chance.
And we had just talked about that. It was probably maybe a week ago. Maybe it couldn't be more. It couldn't be 2 weeks ago. I listened to Pink Floyd for a whole night at work. I went through some of their new stuff. I listened to The Wall. Maybe something in addition to that, and we had talked about it, so I'm kind of surprised you didn't mention this to me.
Well, that's actually what inspired me to do this little experiment. So on the way down, I burned the CDs, or I legally purchased the music off of iTunes.
So you did it old school style? You didn't even play it off of like Spotify? Oh yeah, that's right. Don't even get me into Spotify talking with you.
Well, so two things. One, there's a large swath of area between Dallas and Houston that I don't get internet on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then my car didn't have an auxiliary cord.
You got to get a tape one, man. We got the same tape player.
I don't have a tape deck in my car. It's just a CD and a radio.
That sucks.
Yeah, so I burned a CD, the double disc version of The Wall.
Okay.
And then for the way back, I burned Dark Side of the Moon. And then
it's always called a classic.
Yeah, like the CD cover is just so iconic. I figure there has to be something to it. Everyone at some point has had that T-shirt, right?
Right.
I know. I had.
Right.
I had never heard the album, and I had the Dark Side of the Moon T-shirt. So I had a good, 5 hours of Pink Floyd to listen to? Because that Wall CD goes on forever.
Oh, yeah, it does. When you think it's over, it's like,
no. Track one.
Yeah, exactly. You could never escape.
So I'm really good about being fair to things, right? Like if I'm going to give something a chance, like, I was so against Lost. Like, I hated Lost before I had seen it, and I just thought I was going to give it a fair chance. And you know what? I ended up not totally hating it, okay? I really liked it up until they had to go back to the island. So I was going to give Pink Floyd an honest, real chance.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible.
Terrible.
Like, I just want you to make a song, okay? Not like everything's got to be like, oh, we want you to visualize a light show while we're playing this music, and we're gonna you remember like when REM started putting out all those like experimental albums, and they were all garbage, but they're like, man, it's experimentation with the limits of what sound can do.
Well, that's
like their greatest hits album. It's all like, oh, we're gonna ignore like how songs are supposed to be constructed and like what is actually pleasing to the ear, and just make stuff that probably sounds awesome when you're high.
You know, but I think a lot of like the light show aspect of it, things like that, you're so used to what people usually associate with Pink Floyd now. Like, I don't think they were doing a bunch of light shows and shit back then, were they?
I don't know, but they have to have been, right? Like that was like the what, the late 70s, early 80s?
You know, I say that like I didn't. When I go back and listen to an old band like that that I end up hating usually, I Wikipedia them for like the whole time I'm listening to them. So actually, I don't think they did a lot of light shows, but they did have a very expensive fucking. I think they lost money on the tour for that album because they would perform and they'd have all these people actually building a wall in between them and the audience with cardboard boxes that look like those white bricks, you
See,
know, and
that's
then
a
they'd take
gimmick.
it all down at the end. And oh yeah, gimmicky as hell.
I don't like when you turn your act into a gimmick, unless you start out as a gimmick. Okay. What's a good example? You've
Gallagher.
seen Gallagher is a gimmick. Okay. He has some. Ooh, I had to belch there. He had some fantastic non-Smashing Watermelons comedy. Okay, just fantastic. But it was a gimmick. You went into his show knowing the first row was going to get covered in oranges and watermelon stuff. It was a gimmick. It was okay. There's nothing
Right, nobody
wrong
went
with
there
that.
thinking like, oh man, he is gonna make me think today.
Yeah, so my entire time of listening, the wall was way worse. Dark Side of the Moon, I was able to get through it. It wasn't good. By what I'm not gonna say it's bad, all right, but that wall never ended.
You know, that's kind of how I actually felt that the wall was meh. I didn't think it was terrible when I
I thought it
listened
was
back
terrible.
to it, but I didn't think that it was, I'm not gonna go and listen to it anytime soon again,
Dude,
you know?
and I decided that I wasn't gonna put the Pink Floyd on until I got outside of the range of the Dallas radio stations.
So you couldn't switch if you had the
Yes, that was the idea,
chance?
okay? It's like there's like a 2 hour period of time between Dallas and Huntsville in which you pretty much only get Christian like preachy stations from like the real small towns, and then
Did you
the
consider switching to those even?
no.
Oh.
Pink Floyd better than Christians. And also Spanish language stuff. In those small like ranching towns. So right before I got out of range of the Dallas, like right as it started to like get fuzzy, the radio stations, they were playing Grateful Dead Deep Ellum Blues. Okay, so I went right from that just tremendous, tremendous music of the Grateful Dead, and then I popped in the CD for The Wall, which the first track, if I remember right, is like, oh, we're gonna make a mid-2000s ambience album, but not as good.
Wait, say that again? The
The isn't the first track of The Wall was it's it was like closer to like an ambience album, like something you'd hear in a
just
horror
easy
movie.
listening type shit.
Yeah,
Let me
yeah.
look up the first track here. You know,
You
'cause you know what? I want to say there was like maybe one track where I was like, "You know,
Yeah,
this isn't awful."
there were stuff I would not turn off if it just came on the radio, but
Right.
most of it
That
I
and
would
that's what I
just
mean
turn
by
off.
that. I'm just not that into okay, because you think about it, and you compare them to bands that are like that are talked up as much as they are, like Led Zeppelin or
Led Zeppelin's got some good stuff. It's all stolen from dead black people, but
right.
they have some good stuff.
But you turn on Led Zeppelin and you hear that fucking guitar, you know, it's got like a guitar riff that's gonna come in and fucking take you. That's the thing about Pink Floyd is not one part of the song is that striking or that like notable, you know what
They
I
made an
mean?
entire album without a melody.
Right, like none of it. I no one okay, that should be an experiment we could do. Go out into a city and ask everybody, have you heard of The Wall by Pink Floyd? Every single person will say yes. Now say, could you hum the guitar line to
no.
any song on there?
Well, okay, you might get the... you could hum, not the guitar line, but like there are... I take that back. There are melodies, the... Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. People might be able to do that one, but that's real sing-songy and...
That's 4 minutes of an album that is...
Like a three-hour album, yeah.
Right, that is just ridiculous. But there's no notable, like, bass riff, guitar line, drum... I mean, you could ask people specific Led Zeppelin songs and they could hum you the main guitar riff. You couldn't do that on one of these fucking... I'm looking at them, of these Pink Floyd songs, really.
Yeah. So the conclusion here is that Pink Floyd is fucking terrible. I've tested it. It's now a definitive fact. All right. We're going to get our guest here on the line in just a moment. We'll be right back. All right. You with us?
Yes.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Matt, you can hear him?
Yep. We're all good. Right.
So we're going to get right into this.
Excellent.
All right. Joining us today, our guest, Mr. Christopher Bates. Mr. Bates here is a... music act, goes by the stage name, I'm going to mispronounce this, Tabali Tiggy.
That's pretty much perfect.
Pretty much perfect. Awesome. Tabali Tiggy in the Indianapolis area. And he is also, at least as far as I'm concerned, an expert on cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. And we're going to talk a number of topics here today. Welcome to the show, buddy.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right, right off the top here, let's plug some of your show dates here.
We just had a show. I don't have anything currently. You can check my SoundCloud, bro. Tabali Tiggy.
Spell that.
TABALITIGI.
All right, bam. Check that out.
Yeah, I will be doing shows soon. Just stay posted on Facebook for any shows coming up, but. Nothing planned as of now, but that will definitely change soon.
Right on. So one of the interesting things I find about your shows is like you've got this whole like predator setup. Can you sort of tell us about that and like what the inspiration for that was and how that sort of works during the show?
Well, so the name Tabali Tiggy actually means master of the tables. I've been trying to stay away from the whole DJ moniker. I basically use Tabali Tiggy as sort of a – I also write music, so it's kind of like a character where you have artists like MF Doom or Kool Keith. They do these characters like Dr. Octagon or MF Doom did Victor Vaughn. So you have this –
Slim Shady.
Exactly. You can have a character that becomes its own element of the entertainment aspect. So Tabali Tiggy doesn't talk. There's no, you know, you'll never hear Tabali Tiggy say any words. It's just he comes from Planet Base. It's basically taking the predator, the predator idea and putting it with music to make. There's a story that goes with it. I won't get too much in, you know, as far as like. I'm trying to keep a theme, and there's other people who are in it too. So they're called the Monstars. There's other people that are rappers that, you know, Tabali Tiggy was the first Monstar, and then the other ones are coming. So it's kind of like
so you're just waiting on Michael Jordan to come shut you down on the court.
Exactly. Space Jam.
Yeah. All right, but so tell us a bit about your music. Like, I know when I listen to it, it feels like it's sort of like a modern take on like the jungle genre from the mid 2000s. Would you say that's accurate?
Absolutely. I'm very much influenced by the early jungle. I used to go to parties in 2000. It was pretty much 2000, and Diesel Boy was probably one of my favorite artists.
Yes.
And you know, I saw him live. I don't know how many times, but that he as a producer and a DJ was like what I aspire to be mainly because he took the audience with him. It was like the turntables didn't matter. What he was doing was taking you on a journey with his music. And I understood that from the beginning. I wanted to do that myself, whether it was through something I write or through a DJ mix. And trying to capture that, that's also part of the reason I wear a mask, is because, you know, I want to remove myself from the equation and let the audience just feel the music in the same way that I felt it when I was in the audience. And I try, like, the same experience I had at parties, I want to bring that to people. So that's where, yeah, the music is definitely influenced by early jungle, but that's mainly because I was such a drum and bass head when I was younger. I mean, I still am.
It's definitely refreshing to hear some of that style come back, because it sort of disappeared when, like, the whole bro step thing took over.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I can sit and listen to a Skrillex album, but it's not that, like, driving, engaging thing.
There's a time and place for it. You know, that's why I play dubstep, I play trap, I play hip-hop, I play anything, mainly because, you know, there's a different need at 9 p.m. and 2 a.m. when you're playing for the audience. I play the slower stuff at 9 p.m. I play the faster stuff at 2 a.m.
There's a different level of intoxication and drugs involved.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right on.
You know what I'm talking about.
Right on. So you brought up the mask. Are, like, the people at Universal going to come after you when you get big and famous for this? Or
Hey, that'd be awesome. Because right? if they notice me, then that means I'm doing something right. So
just imagine the publicity.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Getting on Fox News.
Yes, so that would be excellent as far as I'm concerned.
Right on. So hold on 1 second. Just someone at my door here. Pause. All right, just someone dropping off back. Sorry about that. Okay, and cut. So tell me a bit about, the things that go into a performance. Like you show. What I find interesting is that it looks like you got a lot of stuff you got to set up. Like, do you have to, like, bring all that, or, like, how does that work?
That's the beauty of the digital turntables now. I used to do wax, and, you know, you'd have to set up the turntables and the mixer. And you'd have to bring individual records, so you were limited by what you brought. Now I just have my laptop in the digital turntables. So essentially, I can, if someone wants to give me a song on the spot, if someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, can you play this song?" I can play it on the spot, mainly because my setup is really flexible now. That's the, you know, there's actually not a lot. It's just, like I said, there's a laptop and the digital turntables, and mainly to be agile, because when you have an audience, you don't know. Sometimes people want to hear something and they'll come up and ask you to play it, and sometimes they'll have the song with them. And I find it really distasteful when DJs turn down requests. That's one of the things I absolutely hate, and that's part of the reason I don't use DJ in my name. Is because there's a culture of you're going to play a set and then people are there to see you. And if there's people who get offended if an audience member makes a request. So I like to have an agile setup to the point where if somebody brings me a USB drive while I'm playing and says, "Can you play this song?" I'll play it in the middle of my set if I can mix it in. And I've done that to the point where, like I said, this is why I'm in the agile setup now, is to be more interactive with the audience and be able to do things like that where you know, if you're rocking wax, you can't just take a request or just download something instantly and play it in the middle of a set. So that's why I have the setup I have currently.
Awesome. And, you know, like, that really makes sense. Like, you're an entertainer, right? And
exactly.
You're supposed to be there to entertain people. And if people want to hear a song, play it. Like, same thing with, like, rock bands who, like, I don't want to play Start Me Up Again for the 1 billionth time. Or,
yeah.
I get that's what
the crowd wants to hear. You know, that's what your duty is to do. If that's, you know, that's what – it kills me when artists – are they're in their 10th year of their performing, and the crowd wants to hear what they played in their first year, and the artist's like, "I want to play my new stuff," And there's this tension between the two, and it's like, the audience is what put you there in the first place. Without the audience, there is no show. So if you're not there to please the audience, you should just go home. That's like one of the biggest pet peeves I have with artists anymore, is they want to make it a personal practice arena and have the audience is essentially held hostage a lot of times, where, you know, they come to see a certain thing and then the performer's like, I'm going to do this, and this is my prerogative.
Right, it's all about them at that point. It's just, well, I'm only here to play my new stuff. If you don't respect that, well, you could just fuck off. There's a lot of bands that get that attitude anymore.
So this is only kind of related to that, but it just sparked a thing that really bothers me with when I go to see a concert, is the planned encore.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. You dick. Like, I went and saw I'm a reggae nerd now, so I went and saw Soja do a show, and of course, you know, at the end of the show they rip up they have the set list that are taped to the floor and they toss them out in the crowd. I caught one, okay, and I looked at the thing and it's like, oh, break for encore is written right there on the sheet.
Oh,
like, two
no.
Dicks.
Oh,
it's like,
no.
What are you doing?
Oh god. That's terrible, man, because that's where you have to approach it with the sense of maybe you play two encores because the crowd's into it. You can't plan one encore if the crowd's not into it. And this is what I'm saying. There is a set list, and sometimes you have to follow it because you practice it for hours and hours and you can't break it. And I get that. But that's where there is the capacity to flow and move with the audience, and that's something that I believe a lot of musicians need to work on, and that's why they're so rigid and have that planned encore, because they're not actually moving with the audience. And this is kind of what I was getting at before, is like, you have to work with the audience, and then the encores just come. You don't plan the encores, the audience is the one who demands the encore. So that right there, that's the exact type of it's just disgusting. Really?
Well, it just takes away something that should be kind of special between you and a specific audience when you look at a list of what a band's playing for their whole tour and every fucking stop is the same. They paused for 2.5 minutes, left the stage, then the lights came back on and they played this song every place, you know?
Yes, yes. Well, and what you're talking about is one of the reasons I approach my shows the way I do, because no two shows will ever be alike in the way that I perform, because I do not plan out what I play, and everything happens in the heat of the moment. Like, I'll learn a bunch of songs and understand how they work together, but then I'll have to read the crowd to understand what the crowd likes, so then I'll play to the crowd. So then that makes no two shows ever the same. So that's one thing I also despise, is like, as an artist, if you are performing live, you have the opportunity to create a happening. I don't know if you guys are familiar with those. But in the 60s, there were happenings which were trying to capture the art of the now, which is the intrinsic experience of the moment as being art. And that is essentially that feeling you get at a show that you can't have when you're listening to a CD, because the CD is not live. And when you have a complete set that's set front to back, there's not a lot of room for that experience to happen. And even though every show still has differences, that's understanding the happenings and what that moment is trying to capture for the audience is, I think, there's a philosophical aspect that if you're not trying to approach it philosophically, you're just losing it altogether. And I think it's not a disservice to the audience, but there's room to connect in ways that both sides would appreciate more if they made the attempt.
Right on. Definitely. Curious, like, so you, whole show's about flexibility and being able to change things. What do you think about an artist like Girl Talk, who, when he tours,
yeah, I love Girl Talk.
But when he tours, he has one song, you know? On his albums, they break it down into tracks, but it's one continuous mix. And it flows that way for a specific reason. You know, if he changes up that order, it changes the entire thing in a way that's probably not as pleasing to the ear.
Exactly.
So, like, he doesn't have that sort of flexibility just because of the style of music he makes.
Absolutely. The same thing with, like, Aphex Twin or Prodigy, in the sense that I guess Prodigy might have a little more flexibility. But when you have somebody like Girl Talk, this is, again, the audience expectation has been set to a certain point where if he screws up one mix, the audience will hate him for it. You can't, if you're Girl Talk, you cannot screw up one mix live. So at that point, what he is doing is keeping his audience happy. So I have no problems with what he's doing, especially because he constructs everything so well and it's crafted so well when he does it in the studio. For him not to do that live, you can't do that live without screwing it up. Unless you're a superhuman, which is possible. Like Qbert, maybe. Qbert might be able to pull it off. Jmaster J, RIP, I bet he could have pulled it off. You know, there's certain superhuman DJs that could pull it off, but an average I'm not saying Girl Talk is an average DJ, but what he does with his music mixing, it would be 99% impossible to pull off live without screwing up major.
Well, and not only that, he's doing it, you know, shirt off, drenched in sweat, with like half the audience on stage next to him, like pulling on all his cords and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's still like pretty spot on when he does it. So I thought that was super impressive when I saw Girl Talk.
So that's where, you know, what he's doing is not the traditional approach. So I think it's the same thing when you made when the transition was made from acoustic to electric guitar. People are going to start doing things with the tools that they could not do before, and then when you try to compare them to the previous skill sets, it's going to look either like cheating or it's going to look so different that it's going to be hard to put it in the same class. And that's where Girl Talk's doing stuff that's not in the same class anymore, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and it's really, even though it's the same song, it's really hard to fairly compare, you know, a symphony orchestra playing the national anthem to Jimi Hendrix playing the national anthem.
Exactly.
It's such a different animal.
Exactly.
Right on. So we are a little... I'm gonna have to edit this out. Let me look at time. Okay. All right, buddy. Let's move into a slightly different topic here, and that is you have a large, at least in my experience, interest in the cryptocurrency world.
This is true.
So, could you do like a explanation for idiots exactly what is cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and just like the TLDR version of cryptocurrency?
So essentially, what you have with cryptocurrency is a digital ledger that keeps track of transactions at the bottom line. That's money itself is nothing but a ledger. If you look at what a dollar does, all it does is keep track of value. This is the bottom line, whether it's a U.S. dollar or a Bitcoin. You're just keeping track of value. Now, that said, cryptocurrency is a completely digital form of money that keeps track on a public ledger that is visible at all times. So every transaction that happens is visible, and it's tied to an account that is not necessarily tied to a name. So what we're talking about is if you could follow every transaction in the United States in one place, that would essentially be what we're talking about with Bitcoin. It's whether you're keeping track of your savings, what you're spending, what people are giving you. It's all being kept track of in a central location. And this is to keep transparency in the system. And what that does is if you start off with 100 Bitcoin, when you look at the transactions, you can make sure at the end there was only 100 Bitcoin used. So you have counterfeiting with U.S. dollars. This is a major problem. So they've made holograms, they've added magnet strips, they've done all this artwork, they've done all these different colors to prevent counterfeiters from being able to duplicate U.S. dollars. Now, what the blockchain does is it creates
it's the ledger.
This is the ledger that is publicly visible. It creates a self-referencing system to make sure that nothing can be counterfeited ever, because once you start off with X amount of Bitcoin, it will never change however many Bitcoin are in the system. And this is one of the reasons it is better than money that can be printed. When you can print money, it creates inflation, which is not necessarily bad. Bitcoin, there is a set number of Bitcoins that will ever be in existence, so you can't just print more Bitcoins in 5 years. So this makes sure that those things cannot be counterfeited, essentially to function as the ledger. So now that we, as I said, money at the core is to keep track of value. So if you have a money system where counterfeiting is easy, then it's not actually serving its purpose to keep track of value all that well. So this is where, at the core, the major benefits of cryptocurrency come with counterfeit prevention and transparency of spending. So if you have a public ledger of government spending, then they will never be able to say, oh, we spent this on, you know, X, and you can't check what we did because it's in a private ledger.
The black budget.
Exactly. If you have a public ledger, then there will be no more black budgets or hidden spending in government, or the ability for them to say, we'll take your tax dollars and not show you where we're spending it. And this is also one of the, you know, a lot of people are looking at Bitcoin as ways to make money, but really at the core, they are the most useful tools to bring transparency to government and prevent counterfeiting of currencies.
Now, that's a really cool function there, the, you know, more transparency, harder to counterfeit, but isn't a vital function of like paper money the ease of trade? And at least in my experiences of working with cryptos, you know, it's not difficult, but it's definitely less easy to exchange for anything.
Absolutely. And what you're talking about is one of the reasons that it hasn't been adopted by the masses at this point, because there is a cumbersome intermediary between Bitcoin and what you need. So if you buy a Target gift card, it's really easy. It's really easy to buy a Target gift card and use it at Target. It's not that simple to buy something with Bitcoin or even acquire Bitcoin for someone who's not familiar with it. And a lot of people are not willing to admit that. And what is happening now is a lot of mobile banking services and Apple Pay and digital money transferring services they're getting the interfaces and the user experience correct, where Bitcoin has no consolidated there's no consolidated effort to have one interface, which is part of the good thing about it, but at the same time, that's why it's so difficult to get people to adopt it. There's no concerted effort to make it easy.
And also, I know me personally, one of the things that scares me a lot about Bitcoin is the fact that, what, like a year or two ago, one Bitcoin was worth like $1,200, and today it's like $200?
Absolutely.
Like, that's scary to me.
That instability is not good for a currency. So it's Bitcoin also is functioning as a commodity. So what we have right now is a currency that also functions as a commodity, and it's not a stable one. So when you have an unstable currency, it is not good to be the unilateral currency of any economy or anything for that matter. So that instability is terrible for any currency. So what you're talking about is, it's one of the reasons Bitcoin is not a great currency or a great investment. But at the same time, the potential for Bitcoin to change transparency in government spending is revolutionary. That's where, on the one hand, if you look at it purely as an investment from a stockholder point of view, which I don't, Keynesian theory, let's not get into that, but it's not a good investment. However, if you look at it from a revolutionary, let's change the world to make things for the better because we need to make governments more transparent and more responsible for their spending, then Bitcoin is absolutely a revolutionary tool. So it has to be taken and placed in the right context in order to affect the change that whatever side wants it to affect. So if the investors want it to be this commodity that they make a ton of money off, well, they're going to have a bunch of pump and dump groups. They're going to have a bunch of hedge funds that push money into it. It'll go back up and then it'll drop again, just like gold. And then they'll move on to the next thing, like silver, just like is happening right now. So when the gold, everybody was talking about gold was going to hit 3,000 an ounce. Well, it was all people putting money into it, and it was all speculative. So yeah,
how many old people lost their entire retirement because they bought at 1,300 and then it dropped to 600 in, 5 months?
Exactly. So this speculative, this middleman economy where people are buying and selling on speculation, adding value on nothing but speculation, that is not good for anything. It's not like that. It's become a major energy drain on every economy. So what's going to end up happening is the people that actually produce things and have the ideas that are going to take us forward are going to be the ones where the resources and capital needs to go. And all the speculators are going to have to be circumvented because they've done nothing but drain the economy, essentially. They've added nothing back. That's the problem. When you are a speculator, you don't add anything into the economy. And nobody wants to admit that when it comes to buy low, sell high. When you buy low and sell high, what'd you add? Nothing. You just took. So those people, yeah, they make money, but they don't add anything to the economy. So this is where now they are functionally being pushed out by physics. This is where physics comes into play. You have heat and you have entropy and you have a machine that needs to keep moving. If the machine stalls out, it's because these people kept taking energy out of it. But what's happening now is the economic machine is going through a reform where it has to either completely change or it's going to come to a screeching halt. And I don't think the youth in China, the youth in India, the youth in America, or anywhere else are going to let this come to a halt. So this is like where everything, the paradigm, we're all flying on planes that were built in 1980s. You know, all the roads that we're driving on, the trains that we're driving, like all of our infrastructure is 40 years old and it's got to change. And this is where what's happening now is that paradigm shift where the old guard has to kind of let go. They're struggling to keep hold, but this is where our energy approach is going to have to change, our approach to economics, our approach to independent communities where the energy grid, for example, it's going to have to be decentralized. It doesn't make sense to have a centralized energy grid. Water distribution, this drought in California, this is a problem with not understanding distribution of resources. So you have a bunch of people in charge who don't understand physics at the bottom of everything.
Well, and with the water distribution, when you have actual drought, you're fearful that you might straight up run out of water, and The people who get first priority are the almond growers who are using 85% of your water. They're growing almonds. Is the almond industry that important?
This is the problem when you have subsidies, nepotism, and crony capitalism using the guise of government, which is supposed to be in the name of the people, to make terrible decisions. You have all these people making decisions that are not based on efficiency or what the energy of the moment is deciding. They're putting the energy in all the wrong places, which is the reason we're still dependent on oil, and you have Tesla as a private company fighting to bring self-sufficient batteries to homes. Why is that so difficult for someone to bring this type of technology to individuals? And it's like, this is because our government, I won't say the government, this is because the people who are in charge of everything want to stay in charge, and they don't understand the future. They just don't. I don't care if they have money. I don't care if they're billionaires. The people who are in charge don't understand the future, and that's why we're stuck in 1984, essentially.
And with Tesla, they made that illegal to buy in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So Tesla cars in New Jersey are on the same footing with crack cocaine and child porn.
Yeah, exactly.
what type of... You can't put that as some sort of humanistic level where we're making this illegal because some sort of intrinsic harm to society. No, you're just trying to help out industry in your state.
Yep. And what you pointed out, if you're making buying an electric car or something that is making you self-sufficient and taking you off the grid the equivalent of possessing child porn, there's something wrong with that government. There's something wrong with that government, because what you just alluded to is it's a very harsh reality that this government has equated self-sufficiency with abuse of – yeah, that's a very harsh reality.
And there's a case in Oregon where the woman is being charged with collecting rainwater.
Yeah, no, and there's a couple of places where they're, yeah. I mean, in Florida, it was illegal to feed homeless people. That was one of the things that, that was one of the great things that about Bitcoin. This is called Sean's Outpost. This guy, when Florida was trying to make homelessness illegal, there was a couple cities that straight up made it illegal to be homeless. Well, this guy, he ran across America raising awareness about what was going on in Florida, taking Bitcoin donations. They ended up buying a reserve in Florida. I think it's 9 acres. It may be bigger now, but it's called – I think it's Satoshi's Forest. Well, now it's a haven for the homeless. They fed over 100,000 meals to the homeless using Bitcoin donations, and it's this is how you can take Bitcoin and redirect – capital from places where it's not needed to places where it's absolutely needed. Where if somebody's got $5 laying around, they could help buy a reserve in Florida so homeless people aren't being thrown in jail for being down on their luck. And this is something that's already happening. That they call this dude Bitcoin Jesus because, like I said, he ran across the United States on, raising awareness, which is that kind of makes Jesus look like a pussy, man. Like, Jesus only went across the Middle East, man.
Yeah, he just he hung out with fun people all day. If given the chance between, some Romans and, some prostitutes at the time. That dude was kicking it, having fun. And
yeah. He's like, yeah, let's get drunk. I'm going to make this wine of wine. Let's party.
Yeah.
That's right. What, but...
So with the homelessness situation, we have a government institution right now that I forget what state this was in, but the city council's solution to the homelessness problem was not to help the homeless people. It was to put spike strips under bridges. What is it like? We've created a system in which the people who are actually involved in government are able to depersonalize things so much to where that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, and this is where when people become statistics and it's, you know, you talk about the urban welfare queens or whatever, it's very easy to look at the distant people on TV or in the newspaper and look down on them because they've become a number and they've become nothing but a statistic. When it's like, go talk to a homeless person and go ask them about their situation. And I bet once you talk to them, it's going to be a lot harder to look down on that person after you understand why they're there. But when you don't, when you can make that distance and not think about them as an actual person, yeah, you can say, oh, let's put spike strips under there. But you can't look a homeless person in the eye. Like, that's what kills me is all these people, they, like, don't even look homeless people in the eye, and then they make all these legislations about them. You can't look those people in the eye, but you can, you know, dictate how they're going to live. I don't know. With our tax money at that, you know, it's like, this is our tax money going to basically make people into animals. Like, these homeless people are human beings, but they're being turned into animals the way our government's treating them. It's like, you have all these foreclosed homes that the bank is just sitting on, letting go to waste. It's like, really? You guys are allowing this bullshit to happen, and we're supposed to sit here and say this is okay? I don't fucking think so.
Yeah, and so let's look at the example of Utah. They're like the good guys in this whole situation, where their solution for homelessness is we're gonna give landowners tax credits if they rent out apartments for free to homeless people, and we'll put a social worker on them that'll help them get a job, help them they need to go to rehab, help them get through that. And you know what? Save money, because you know we have to arrest homeless people a lot of times because we've made it illegal to sleep on the streets. You know, save a bunch of money just, you know, giving people a home.
Yeah.
And it's not like people aren't able to find apartments who have a job and everything, because you just have a surplus. And all the states around them are pissed.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, because it makes them look bad. It makes – when you implement logical, rational, and humanitarian laws, it makes everybody look bad, because then you realize everybody else isn't doing it. You know, I mean, I'm 31, I'm 32, I don't even know how old I am. I'm 32 years old.
I do that all the time.
We're still talking about the same dumb shit when I was a kid, because these idiots in charge, they can't get along with each other. So how are they going to, like, you know, be the liaison between two groups that can't get along? So this is where.
And these are the people who had no fucking problem finding the money to pay for us to invade Iraq twice.
Yeah.
But both times they did it, it's a huge fight for them to, hey, we have a homelessness problem. Let's, like, off the top, let's make sure that we don't have people who we just sent to some foreign country for hardly a good reason at all, and the second time, no good reason. Let's make sure none of those people are homeless first. And no, it's a huge percent of our homeless who were in those wars that we had no problem paying for.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like if the soldiers that are in Iraq were building stuff in America, and if the police in America that are harassing people were helping, like if every time somebody was in, like, under duress, the cops were there rather than harassing people, like, people wouldn't hate cops. If I didn't grow up having to worry about being thrown in jail simply because of the color of my skin, I would not have this predisposition not to like them. And my thing is, I don't really hate cops. I just am constantly worried about going to jail for nothing. And that's because they look at me and they have this predisposition to say, hey, this guy has all these traits that I've been trained to associate with a criminal. And I'm like, you know, do I need to wear my degrees on my shoulder so these cops don't look at me like that? Because when I leave America, cops don't look at me the same way. People don't look at me the same way. This is an American problem where the cops are trained to look at certain groups in a certain way. It's not just blacks. It's not just Mexicans. It's poor whites. If you're a white person that wears like a certain type of clothing, cops are going to look at you in the same way too. It's not just black people. So it's not even about race.
And this is like part of what I'm studying right now. And one of the major issues with our criminal justice system right now is this idea of the warrior cop. Mm-hmm. So so let's back up a little bit further than I was going to go there. We had the Rodney King riots, okay?
Yes.
And between and during that whole late 90s period, we saw actual, like, real movement towards a more positive police citizen experience. We had fewer police brutality complaints. We had we had falling crime. We had a situation in which the public perception of the police was actually getting better.
Yes.
And then 9/11 happened, and police turned into the, quote, first line of defense against terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to give them camo fatigues. We got to give them MRAPs and grenade launchers. And, we have a bunch of soldiers coming home from Iraq who are, you know, military trained. They know how to follow orders. They're older, more mature, and they know how to shut up and, again, take orders. So our police hire a bunch of military vets who shockingly show up and treat the U.S. like they're still in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire culture has gone from what we were making pot. Prior to the Rodney King situation, there was a culture of just like brotherhood. It was a fraternity that everyone just protected their own, and we still have that, but it was a lot looser. It wasn't a professional, you know, job that you had to like treat people nice. We had like real movement towards like a guardianship position, in which people weren't enemy combatants, and then cops are first line of defense against terrorism, so now...
Well, drug war, too. I mean...
Well, the issues with the war on drugs, that's...
Because what happened with Cabrini-Green and all of those, all of those places where the drug war created kingpins and left them without any sort of... government intervention, and then comes back to use those places as examples of why they need militarized police. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy that they basically started, especially now that we know that all that stuff with Freeway Rick Ross was real.
Yeah.
When you have all of these things retroactively being confirmed as being real, now we have to go back and say, look, these people are the ones that created the fucking problem. So how are they going to be the ones that solve it? Let's not let this bullshit keep going, because they created this problem. They're not going to have the capacity to understand how to fix it. Or if that's even their goal. And that's why when you have the poppy fields being protected by U.S. soldiers over in Afghanistan, and then the heroin's coming over here, and now we know what they were doing 30 years ago, it's not a fucking conspiracy theory anymore. We know it's a goddamn conspiracy. We know they were working on this shit. So let's not let them fucking do it anymore. So that's where I'm like, you know.
Another thing we know about the poppy fields is that poppy was not a major export out of Afghanistan prior to the U.S. showing up.
Yep.
It was not a cash crop. Like, it wasn't economically viable to grow.
Nope.
And also, Al-Qaeda crack down on that shit. Like, the people who were growing poppy, Al-Qaeda didn't want that stuff around.
Yeah.
But then we show up and it's like everyone's growing poppy.
I mean, British East India Company. It's like nobody has read their fucking history, man. This is the getting people addicted to drugs.
Yeah, that's
opium specifically.
That's the go-to in China.
That's the go-to. This is like the British fucking game plan. Not let alone, it's like when BP happened in America and nobody is holding BP accountable or the government accountable. It's like, are we still a fucking British colony? Are we still a fucking British colony? Because when people are like worried about the princess's baby and shit, I'm like, I thought that's why we fucking broke away. We're supposed to be not paying British people money for our oil. We're not supposed to not be paying attention to the princess's fucking baby. Like, in my opinion, I think where we are now, where you have Americans who are are trained to call someone else to protect them. That is un-American. The whole reason this country was founded was to be able to be autonomous, to protect your own. When you're not protecting your own house, that's un-American. And that's where it's – what's going on is so I hesitate to ever call the people in government American, because what they're doing is completely contrary to what the founding fathers did, or as I see it, intended. And to that point, it's become so such a tyranny of this small majority in power that I'm like wondering how long this feudalism will last, because we're still stuck in a feudal existence, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, especially when you look at student loans. Come on, you might as well call it indentured service. So until we get enough people realizing we're still in a feudal existence, I'm not sure if we're going to get out of it. But that's why I'm working on the other side, you know. I stay positive.
Hey, Matthew.
Yes.
Have we bored you to death yet?
No.
Actually, I don't have much to say there.
It's been kind of cutting in and out here on the Skype, but
really? Oh,
I've got it the last couple minutes.
Got that poor people internet there.
Yeah, I do. Actually, the truck's outside. He must be working on something.
Oh, right on. Okay, I thought we bored you to death there. Well, let's move back a little to cryptocurrency, and I want to get your take on Dogecoin.
Okay, Doge. I really liked Doge as an experiment. Mainly because the idea was to not take it seriously, and it's a good way to get into cryptocurrency without this feeling of, you know, trying to make money. It's not so serious to you feel like you're going to lose your life savings if you, you know, get into Dogecoin. And the community is always tipping, so you're more than likely going to get Dogecoin for free and not have to pay anything to get it. That's like I said, why I like the Doge community is because they're not all serious, and it's a lot of people interested in helping. So they do a lot of charity work. They sponsored the Jamaican bobsled team.
Yeah.
So little stuff like that, where the Doge community is all about charity.
But I can say we, because I was a contributor in Dogecoin.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You've been there for a while.
We as a community, contributed and had, water wells dug in Kenya. Mm-hmm. We supported a teacher in Hungary who getting – long story there. It's not all – you know, one of the things we've done several times now is we've sponsored NASCAR races.
Mm-hmm.
Like I will always be able to say that I was a co-sponsor of a NASCAR car in NASCAR.
Exactly.
Like that's so cool. I'm an actual co-sponsor for several of them. I have a little copper coin that was used for that, and you know, like that's cool. But there's also a whole bunch of this charity stuff that that we do, and people aren't so tight with their money. Like, it's so hard to get people to, if you're soliciting for donations to get people to throw in $5, but the people in the Dogecoin community, everyone's like, oh, here's 10, here's 5.
Uh-huh, exactly. And that's why you can't not love that community. It's full of so many good people that are so charity minded where it's like, you just, when you when you encounter people in the Doge community, you just end up happy, because like I said, they're just good people in general. Where with Bitcoin, you don't get that same feeling. It's like people in Bitcoin community are just trying to take advantage. And this is that culture I was referring to. It's like, it's the Doge community does so much with their energy because they understand how to direct it. They don't have to worry about sapping energy from people because they know how to redirect things and say, look, if we all take $5, we can sponsor this person over here, and it's going to propel them to a place where they couldn't get on their own. And that's why the Doge community is so awesome, is they're community minded, and that's invaluable to me. I just love that.
Anytime I've done research on Bitcoin, I inevitably end up on that Bitcoin talk forum or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And I'm just always just shocked at how massive dickheads people are to each other over there.
It's toxic.
It's like really toxic. It's unbelievable. So the community aspect of Dogecoin, is or could Dogecoin become a viable alternative to Bitcoin, or are there structural issues you see there that would prevent it from? Dogecoin is based off the Bitcoin technology, right? So all the benefits you brought up before, other than a Dogecoin does have inflation mechanisms in there.
Yes, exactly. They have counterbalances too now. But to that point, where I think Doge will fall, it won't be an alternative to Bitcoin necessarily, but I see it becoming something that charities end up probably accepting pretty universally. Like, they'll probably accept Bitcoin as well just because, but I imagine charities will get more donations through Dogecoin over time than Bitcoin. Just based on my personal experience, and that's where I think it's going. You know, I think Doge is going to be a big player in the charity cryptocurrency toolbox.
Well, even for like actual goods and services transactions, I know. Last thing I purchased on with Dogecoin was a subscription on Twitch. Mm-hmm. Which is a video game sharing thing, and on their list of like payment options, it's credit card, PayPal, Dogecoin. Then you have to go like two pages over before you hit Bitcoin. So that tells me that they have way more people actually using Dogecoin to buy their service.
Well, I was in my research, what I found was that there were more active Dogecoin users than Bitcoin users in 2014 in America. And then on further, the people who held Bitcoin were less likely to spend it than people who had Dogecoin. So you have hoarders and speculators with Bitcoin, and then people who have Doge are charitable and also spenders. So that's more intrinsically why those patterns will emerge, which it makes perfect sense.
Isn't that a good thing for the current? Because like the main thing with currency is adaptation, right? Like,
yes, absolutely.
The more people are actually using it, and viability is of a currency is inherently based on its like circulation. So I obviously I'm biased here in that I'm not a Dogecoin investor, but I'm someone who, like, if I'm going to play poker online, I do so with Dogecoin. Mm-hmm. If I have the option of buying something with Dogecoin, I will, because I enjoy using it a lot of times because of it's the connectivity with the community aspect, and by increasing circulation, you increase the value for everyone. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. But that increase in circulation, doesn't that make it more viable?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's why it's lasted so long. Like, you know, it was originally intended to be a joke. You know,
yeah,
this
was a joke.
This was supposed to be a joke. This was not supposed to be something that caught on like this. So that's where I think with what Doge has done culturally, Bitcoin cannot do. So I believe Doge will excel past Bitcoin in many. It probably already has in a lot of ways, as far as like, you know, you're much more likely to be able to talk to someone about Dogecoin without getting a repulsive response or repelling them. People are repelled by Bitcoin because of the negative, whether it's Silk Road, people being burnt on bad investments or whatever. There's just been so many negative things associated with Bitcoin that are not associated with Doge. It's got a clean slate. It's got a great meme behind it. It's got a great story behind it. It's not serious. It's serious enough economically that it works. So I think as a package, Doge is better than Bitcoin in a lot of ways. And that's why it's, you know, Bitcoin is like 7 years old,
Yeah.
And Dogecoin's like 3 years old, I think, or 3 or 4 now. But that's where, in the amount of time, Doge has caught on way more. So with looking at the adoption curves, I think, yeah, Doge is on track to be more not necessarily accepted than Bitcoin, but be more socially relevant than Bitcoin or culturally relevant.
And you brought up the Silk Road and the Dread Pirate Roberts, I think his name was.
Yeah.
He was from Fort Worth. He was from Fort Worth, so down the street. So that was like a big trial here. And I kept wondering, like, if he the fact that Robert Obricht, I could only remember his little screen name there. The fact that that had to be a service done in Bitcoin is, I think, more telling than any sort of the guy was kind of scummy, right? Like that's a truth there. You know, if it wasn't the Silk Road, that guy was probably someone who would have found another way to be a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that a major early market for Bitcoin was to anonymously buy drugs online, people treat that as an indictment of cryptocurrency in general, when that should be an indictment of the fact that you can't just buy weed.
Right, and not, I mean, no, you know, how many U.S. dollars are used to buy drugs every day?
Oh, yeah, and another criticism is that, like, Bitcoin can be used to launder money. But, yeah. Like, if you're laundering money, you just use cash, because that can't be tracked at all.
Yeah.
You brought up Silk Road, and that brings up a whole just I say this way too often on the show. I'm studying criminology, so like one of the things I always see when I see a crime like that is like what just cut all the bullshit out, and what are you looking at there? And you have a guy who is exploiting a market for something that shouldn't have been illegal.
Exactly.
And Bitcoin and I was getting someone Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general. Have become a way to circumvent bullshit laws.
Yeah, and I think this is where laws that don't make sense in a time where people have access to information, people stop following laws that don't make sense because it's if you follow a law that doesn't make sense as an individual, it sets one down a path where it you start questioning your own ability to make decisions, and then you don't give yourself authority over your own body. And I think that's where when people are told that you can't smoke weed, and then it doesn't make sense as to why, like there's no logical reason as to why, that starts people to not trust authority. So you have bad rules. Nobody's gonna follow any rules.
And you know, name an illegal drug.
Weed.
Okay, marijuana was made illegal because the Mexican migrant workers would use it, and it was seen as some potentially dangerous thing that they didn't want the white women to get.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, name another illegal drug.
Ecstasy.
Party drug. You had some. Kids dehydrate themselves, and you completely ignored all of its medical benefits and how it was being what it was, which was a treatment for the Germans developed it. It was a treatment for some psychological disorder. What I'm getting at there is every drug that is currently illegal in the United States is illegal because of who used it, rather than some sort of intrinsic harm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ecstasy would not have been made illegal if it wasn't seen as like this like thing that these scoundrel kids were getting high on when they went to go see the Tabali Tiki show. You know, like it wouldn't have been made illegal. Cocaine would not have been made illegal if it wasn't being so widely used by black dock workers in Louisiana.
Right.
That's why. the whole so one of the big things that happened when cocaine was being made illegal was there were all these newspaper reports of, pardon my language, cocaine crazed niggers running wild on the streets and raping white women.
Oh God.
Okay, which that was in the news like everywhere. There was news reports everywhere. And like people have spent like years trying to research and trying to find the actual case in Louisiana that's in reference to. It didn't exist. There was not a black on white rape that was attributed to the use of cocaine. Okay. Like it's not a thing that happened. It was made up, and it was during a push to make cocaine illegal. And that was something that was, I mean, Freud, one of his big things was Freud used cocaine like several times.
Oh,
like
crazy! Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. He was a cokehead. He was a cokehead. Okay, like cocaine was like just a normal part of society, and then suddenly, oh. It's this thing that the black people use before they rape the white women. It always comes back to raping white women. You know, heroin made illegal because the Asians like to smoke opium. And, you know, why they like to smoke opium? Well, because we got them hooked on it. Drugs in this country were all made illegal because of who did them rather than some sort of intrinsic harm. But if you ask your average citizen and you ask him, it's because of some intrinsic harm. They think it's because of intrinsic harm. And if you think that marijuana is damaging to you and it's harmful and it can cause you to go crazy, then it's really not an issue of your decision making, because that'd be the correct decision then, right?
Yeah.
If you believe that pot's bad for you and you follow that law, it's more an issue of education, it's more of an issue of people being taught one thing and not questioning others.
Mm-hmm.
which is a big problem in and of itself.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And getting back to my original point there, the fact that Mr. Ulrich he got like what, 40 years in prison for
something ridiculous.
No one looked at, well, should what he did be illegal? Now there are some things that you shouldn't be able to buy with money or Bitcoin. Okay, on Silk Road, couldn't you like hire hitmen and stuff like that?
Well,
like,
I think that's where he got in trouble. Is like he. I don't know if he tried to hire a hitman or something, that's where they were getting really in trouble, because they had murder for hire. Yeah, no, he does have murder for hire charges. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Then yeah, he's a criminal for that shit. Okay.
Yeah.
But the other thing is like I think everyone's seen the deep web post about the guy who was selling children. With Bitcoin, like there is something to say about perhaps cryptocurrencies are too anonymous.
They're not. They're pseudonymous, and part of it is they're not anonymous. Like they found that dude. You know what I mean? The idea that cryptocurrencies are anonymous is a myth. Even the best tumblers have digital trails and
Tumblr.
Something that is an intermediary to remove addresses between transactions. So if I send something to you, it'll send, like, say I send you 100 Dogecoin, then it'll buy something else and then send you X amount of X coin. So it looks like it's, like, coming from somewhere else, but there's still a digital trail. So that's where... Yeah, there's ways to anonymize transactions, but it's always going to leave a digital trail. And that's, you know, what anybody who says otherwise is not – they don't understand forensics, clearly.
Right on. So I guess my question is then there's a lot of smart people involved in Bitcoin, but, like, I was under the impression that it was all anonymous.
No, it's not. It's absolutely not. So with Bitcoin, Here's the best analogy that I've heard. With Bitcoin, you have a safe. Bitcoin would be the equivalent of a safe. Anyone has a lockbox in that safe that you can go in. When you go in and access that lockbox, it's like you're wearing a mask. But that lockbox and you walking in there is on camera. So if somebody wants to come in and figure out what time that person was going into that lockbox, they'll see that person, they'll see the timing, they'll see everything, and then they'll say, okay, what else can we connect this with to see if this was the person? So then they'll look at the IP address. Oh, does this IP address match this other person's IP address? Well, yeah, they do. So we can say, yes, it was you from this computer going in to this Bitcoin transaction at this time. So, yeah, it's not tied to your name, but because of digital footprints that happen from everything, there's always a digital footprint from anything you do on a computer, pretty much. So unless those people are really good at, even when you wipe it, there's a trail. So that's where it's like, it's impossible to do anything without letting someone know that you were doing something. It's pseudonymous, it's not anonymous, and with enough energy and tangential information, Bitcoin transactions can be identified with an individual.
I remember maybe a year or so ago, some guy stole a bunch of Bitcoin from like the Mexican cartels. Mm-hmm. You remember this?
Yeah.
And like they were chasing him through the blockchain, trying to find the dude.
Yeah, what he was doing was tumbling. It was called tumbling. It's like I said, you're sending transactions from one account to a different one to try to make it look like there's multiple transactions going on that have nothing to do with each other, but really it's the same person.
Did that guy ever get caught? Like, did the cartel catch up to him?
I'm not sure. Let me see. That's one of those things where looking at the way situations played out, I bet they did. I mean,
like he stole like tens of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin, right? Like,
I bet they found him because there was a couple thefts that I know happened where the people, they stole hundreds of thousands and were found by like the next weekend or the next week. And this is where, like I said.
Speaking of thefts. Can you give us a little breakdown of exactly what the hell happened with Mt. Gox?
Okay, so that's still even playing out.
Really? Still going on? This is like, I thought it collapsed like a year ago.
Well, I guess in the sense of how they're trying to resolve it. So
okay.
There's a lot of speculation as to what went on behind the scenes. Basically, when it was all starting to go down, Mark Karpeles actually sent out a bunch of frantic tweets talking about how he was going to be the fall guy for this situation, basically saying that what was going to happen was going to happen. And then his account disappeared. Well, I happened to be one of the people that was seeing those tweets. So when everything went down, I had this predisposition to think that it was all him being made to look like a patsy. So now, all these years later, when he has not been held accountable for anything, and there's more information coming to light where there are NSA agents that were stealing Bitcoin because they were operating on Silk Road as rogue agents, and then you find out stories like that where they were going in and stealing and setting other people up. I'm more inclined to think that Karpeles got taken advantage of, got set up, got put in a place to look like he did something that he may have been complicit in, but I'm more inclined to think that he didn't. I think those Bitcoin are being held by a government, not necessarily the U.S. government.
He's from Japan, right?
No, I believe he's French. He's in Japan.
In Japan, okay.
Yeah, Mt. Gox is in Japan.
And we skipped a couple of steps here. Mt. Gox was at one point the largest Bitcoin exchange in the world.
Exactly.
And it collapsed, and it's alleged that I can never pronounce his name, but the head guy basically took all the Bitcoin that were held in storage and ran with it.
Yeah.
And it's hundreds of millions of dollars, right?
I think like $800 million, maybe.
$800 million worth of Bitcoin, and he just took it. And that's what's alleged there, and there is a bunch of issues with, you know, could he be charged with fraud in Japan? Well, Bitcoin's not considered money in Japan, so not really, stuff like that.
Oh, it's $600 million, yeah, sorry.
$600 million. Yeah. Oh, only $200 million difference. Like, it's like only like when you're talking about 800 or 600 million, we're still talking about like I'd take 1 million. And we're talking about so much larger than that. Like, you can live a pretty good life anywhere in the world with $600 million.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So, another topic I wanted to talk about is something that you shared through your Facebook, and it got me reading on it, and I was really fascinated by the concept. And it is BitLand. Can you tell me about the BitLand project? Tell our listeners. Okay.
So what BitLand is focused on is going into undocumented land areas where the governments, the local governments, have not built the infrastructure to be able to handle the land titles in the rural areas. So the area that we're looking at right now is Kumasi in Ghana.
And this is the project that you're actually like directly involved in.
Yes. Okay. I'm the chief security officer currently. So what's happening is there are, like I said, there are many countries where there are undocumented land areas that people are just squatting. And it goes further than squatting, to where people have been living there for 10 years or 20 years, and everybody in the local community recognizes each other as owning the land, but there's no actual documentation. So what we're trying to do is make a software suite that would allow small individuals to start documenting land titles, to say, hey, you can now take this to the government and sell your land or get a mortgage or get equity on it to be able to start a business. As to now, all the land being undocumented is basically untapped resources. So this is one of the things that when you have a land title, it allows equity to be held. It allows, like I said, you can in turn sell that land to someone else, whereas if you don't have a title, you can't legally trade hands. So this is where without creating new government organizations to do this, if we are able to do this as a private nonprofit organization where we can create the tools, create the processes and procedures, then we can go to the governments and say, hey, we'll help you start documenting the land, and also make the liaison with the local community so the people understand why it's good for them to have land documents and land titles. Because If it's done improperly, it can look like you're just trying to
take their land from them.
Yeah, exactly. You're just trying to take their land and say, hey, we're going to come in and do something for you, but it's really going to only benefit us. Well, if we can explain to the people why it will benefit them to document their land and why that will actually be good for them, then it won't be difficult to get them on our side and to get them to work with the governments where they weren't before.
Now, the reason why this fascinates me so much, and I really like the idea, is that whereas like Bitcoin, you're using the analogy you used earlier, using a ledger to notate the distribution of value, with the BitLand project, you're developing a system which you're using a ledger to notate the distribution of land, which is a lot more concrete. You can like go there, like you can't. value is intangible. It's a concept. With the land, that's a thing that you can actually go to and look at, which makes it a lot, in my mind, a lot more feasible as something that can be deployed in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an unfair assessment?
No, not at all. Well, and this is not so much to create a token that's attached to land, but more so because the Bitcoin blockchain is the ledger, having that public ledger as something that is decentralized that land titles can be attached to, well, all of a sudden, now these governments don't need to buy servers. They don't need to buy their own they don't have to house all the information because it's being stored on the blockchain at this point. So this is how going in and working with the governments to make their land titles more efficient with blockchain technology reduces a lot of overhead in ways that, in America, it would almost be impossible to do because there's too much infrastructure in the way. So when you have very little infrastructure in place, it has the potential to have something like this come in and catapult it to a very modern paradigm that's almost futuristic, if it's executed correctly.
So I have a couple technical questions here. How does in my mind, there would be a difficulty in establishing within a blockchain land areas that are like have oblong shapes. It seems like it'd be a lot easier to do grids, but like not everyone's land is like situated like a grid.
Right, and this is one of the things that we're working on. There's a couple different approaches. So we're working with a team that is working on a graphic user interface to have it so somebody, if they're using their mobile device, they'll be able to draw out the surveyed land on the map, like on the Google map right there. So yes, if it's like an oblong shape,
It's like here to a river, and like rivers aren't straight, you know?
Right. Well, then what would happen is, say you're holding your cell phone, you just walk the border. So then it would track the border with your device. So that's where it's like, it normal surveying tools aren't going to be accessible to everyone. So we have to make solutions that use what is accessible. So you take your GPS device and you walk the perimeter, or if you're there and you can visibly see it, you can draw the perimeter with the device. So it's not, obviously it will have to be checked for integrity, and this is another thing that, you know, is part of the system. You can't just have people arbitrarily drawing their own borders that don't check with the central system.
My other question is that so like what you're trying to do is you're gonna like start off, you're gonna take like a snapshot of today, right? Who claims what land here today? And then move forward from there, right?
Yes.
So what about, anytime there's people laying claim to land, there's going to be land disputes. If you're taking a snapshot today of land, how do you already have ideas how you're going to rectify currently existing land disputes in these areas in which, you have two people who both claim the same little spot?
Oh, that's going to have to go through the government. That's where we as a nonprofit organization can't settle land disputes that are under government authority. That's where it's going to have to be, like, our project is going to have to go through the government in order to function. Where there's also a project starting up in Honduras that's not the same team, but we're working with a similar group.
Similar concept.
Well, not even just that. I also work with the Factum team, which is a digital record-keeping decentralized organization. So Factum is basically going to be the backbone of record-keeping, not just for land titles, but the BitLand team is going to use Factum to store the records. And then the team that's in Honduras is also going to use the Factum record keeping to store their records. So this is where, like I said, governments are going to have to be involved if there are land disputes, because something that's been going on for years probably hasn't been settled because the government hasn't stepped in. So, you know, maybe we can arbitrate, but it's ultimately going to have to be settled by a government.
Well, and I guess part of the issue that arises in my head there is governments, a major problem-solving mechanism for governments when it comes to land disputes is land titles, which is something that you're trying to set up.
Mm-hmm.
So like the major dispute resolution tool that a majority of governments would use for that is what you're trying to create. And I guess the main utility of the service would be in places with extremely ineffective governments, and it would seem like that'd be a major issue, that you have governments that are unwilling, unable solve land disputes, and those land disputes are the reason why your service is needed, but your service can't utilize because of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, and that's a great that is a great criticism of the problem, because yes, the part of the reason that those areas are unserviced is not just because of the government, but because the people aren't complying or cooperating with the government or each other necessarily. So this is again where maybe it won't work every place, but part of the reason BitLan is trying to be the liaison is to be able to explain to the people who are having the land disputes why it's more beneficial for them to settle those disputes and move forward rather than to perpetually stay in limbo as to who actually owns the land.
So tell our listeners, if we want to support, it's a nonprofit, right?
Yes.
And at least in my opinion, it's a valuable service that you have the potential to provide to people, especially in, in the developing world. You know, you're not picking the center of Nairobi. You're going out into rural Ghana, right?
Yes.
So I mean, if your money is going to go to help, this is a good place to help. And it's a valuable service that can really improve people's lives. How can our listeners help support?
Even now, we're not currently asking for money. We're trying to get GPS-enabled devices. We're doing a cell phone drive in Indianapolis right now. If anyone can mail devices, that'd be awesome. I wouldn't expect it necessarily, but right now, what is needed is the GPS devices to be able to have people understanding how to use the interfaces and be able to use the application. So, like I said, money is going to come later for operations as far as when we start taking donations and everything. But like I said, we're not even asking for money right now, because what's most important is getting the devices, where tons of people have old cell phones laying around that have that can connect to the internet and have GPS on them. So this is where it's like, you know, we'd rather have that right now than $5 or whatever, because it's actually much more useful in getting us to where we need to be.
Right on. So if any of our listeners, everyone's got like an old iPhone laying around somewhere, right? So did you get Chris, an email or something? Yeah.
Yeah, it's chrisbates01@gmail.com.
That's with a CH, not a K.
Yes.
All right.
BATES.
So, yeah, so I really like the concept behind this project, and if what consists of our listener base can help in any way, I would like for them to do so.
That's much appreciated.
All right, buddy. It's been fun having you on. Appreciate you.
It's been real. I appreciate you guys having me on. It's much pleasure. We should do this again sometime.
Yeah, definitely. And Matt had to drop off there. He has some poor people internet problems, but I'm sure he would. He has the same sentiment. We got pretty technical there at parts, and he's not really good at that stuff. But I'm sure he was fascinated.
Man, that hour and a half just blew by. That's crazy.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. All right, buddy. We'll see you again soon, sometime, I hope.
Thanks. Have a wonderful day. Take care.
Bye bye. Your head, grab a beer, go online.